Hello and welcome to The Wire, where we've got independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station all around Australia. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on The Wire today...
I mean, is the Republican Party going to become a party of fantasy, of conspiracy?
After a short interregnum, we again hear that Donald Trump is claiming that, in fact, he won the last US presidential election. Why should anyone be interested? Well, at the recent CPAC event in Florida, he strongly hinted that he was going to get back in the saddle and run for president. Also on the program...
The formation of Mushroom Records through to the Frontier Touring Company.
Today, the man behind the Frontier Touring Company, Mushroom Records, and the success of much of Australian music from the 60s to this current day, died in Melbourne at 68. I speak with Stuart Coop, who knew Michael and the contribution he has made to Australian music. Stay tuned to all of this and more coming up on The Wire. Critics are concerned that the government's proposed online safety bill gives the eSafety Commissioner too much power to censor the internet. Under the legislation, the eSafety Commissioner will be able to remove offensive material at their discretion or material that is subject to complaints made by Australian internet users. Toby Hemmings asked Lucy Kraltsova, Program Manager at Digital Rights Watch, how the online safety bill will work.
The online safety bill introduces new powers for the eSafety Commissioner to take down certain content online. Well, this is chiefly targeted at child exploitation material, sharing of non-consensual nude imagery, cyberbullying, and other harms that come to our communities on the internet. However, it's drafted very broadly, and some of the powers give a lot of freedom, I think, to interpretation to the Safety Commissioner's office.
So what is meant when they say there's going to be Class 1 content and Class 2 content online?
Well, Class 1 refers to refused classification, and this is anything that is revolting or abhorrent phenomena, things that go against the Australian standards of morality, decency, and propriety, I think, generally accepted by reasonable adults. That can mean a lot of things, but that classification already exists. Class 2 material that the bill also talks about is content that is likely to be rated 18 plus or rated R, and that includes nonviolent sexual activity or anything that is unsuitable for a minor to see. There's just a lot of room for discretion for what that can mean based on, you know, a person's religious beliefs or anything else that kind of impacts, you know, what we view as moral and decent in society.
With this idea of morality, do you think that this opens up a greater potential for commissioners to unilaterally determine what is offensive in these situations?
There's a real political willingness to just trust the eSafety Commissioner. The powers are exercised in a way that aligns with the intent, which is a little bit naive, and it's a little bit of the cult of personality that we see in politics. But realistically, when you draft legislation, you have to think about what a different administration would do with those sorts of powers.
The adult cyber abuse content scheme. Now, I know the minister has said this is a world first initiative, but what does it actually look like in the legislation?
An overarching theme for a lot of these powers is they're not checked against abuse. As much as I can make a complaint that non-consensual imagery was shared of me, and I think that sort of power is really overdue, there's also nothing preventing people from filing malicious complaints to the commissioner. I think the definition is something that a reasonable Australian adult would find offensive or unseemly. This is exactly just really ripe for abuse, for people to file vexatious complaints or flood the commissioner with complaints so they take that material down.
Do you believe that this is a belated push to assert state sovereignty over the World Wide Web?
I think Australia is trying to create an Australian internet, which is tragic. We've seen other countries try and do that. You know, it will be incredibly hard to roll some of these powers back. And the sort of internet that it creates, creating this domestically, they're really sending the message across Asia Pacific and across globally to say, yeah, we're also done. Actually, we're done with the international internet. We're done believing that we can come to an international forum and a consensus, and we will regulate the way we want to regulate.
Lucy, I've just received an email from a spokesperson for the Minister of Communication who's just told me that the approach of eSafety has always been to prioritise content depicting child sexual abuse and exploitation, as well as material that incites, instructs or promotes terrorism or violent extremism, and this wouldn't change under the Act. Do you think that that's a fair justification for the provisions in the Act as we see them?
I agree with the noble goals of that, but then draft the bill in a way that strictly delineates that, because those are not the definitions that are in the bill.
Lucy Kraltsova, Program Manager at Digital Rights Watch, speaking there with Toby Hemmings. The dispute between the Modi government in India and the nation's farmers remains a significant national problem. Formal negotiations have been abandoned, but tensions and protests continue. Rob Osborne spoke to independent Indian journalist Abir Dasgupta and asked him first to outline the recent developments.
The farm laws are in a state of legal limbo right now. They are unimplemented and seemingly unimplementable. What was earlier a protest led by farmers' union now has become a protest that has engulfed an entire region. So effectively, the entire region of, you could call it Greater Punjab in India, that has risen up in this protest. While these protests continue at the various sites at the borders around Delhi, now the committee of protesting farmers have taken it deep into the rural heartland all around the region. There have been massive gatherings, which are called Mahapanchayat, which see hundreds of thousands of people gathered across villages of a particular region. The BJP leaders are facing what is known as a social boycott. They are not, many villages across the region are saying, we won't allow BJP leaders to enter our villages. We won't have many of the BJP leaders, especially in Punjab, now have a permanent protest around their house.
The Modi government has also become embroiled in a dispute with Twitter over attempts to suppress support for the farmers on the platform. Using provisions in existing security laws, the government ordered Twitter to block over 500 accounts and threatened people working for the company in India with legal action, up to 7 years in prison, if they refused to do so. Abhir Dasgupta explains what happened next.
Initially, Twitter did comply. For about half a day, all these accounts were taken down, and then they were restored. And what we've been told is that this decision was made by Twitter's US headquarters, overruling in Twitter's India team. And while most of the accounts remained suspended or unavailable for Indian users to see, the prominent ones, including politicians and news media, were restored.
As part of its strategy to respond to Twitter, the government has adopted an Indian microblogging app called Coup. Government supporters, ministers and officials have opened accounts on this recent Twitter clone, which offers messaging in 8 Indian languages. Twitter has indicated that it will continue to advocate for the right of free expression on behalf of its estimated 15 million Indian users and is exploring options under Indian law. In recent weeks, coverage of the dispute has more or less disappeared from the mainstream international media, presumably because there have been no spectacularly violent clashes between the farmers and the authorities. However, in an intriguing development, coverage on alternative media, used predominantly by young people, has exploded. Some commentators suggest this follows comments on Twitter by singer-actor Rihanna about the plight of Indian farmers. Perhaps the most prominent commentator is American Hassan Piker, an influencer and gamer whose audience spans countries and ethnic backgrounds. His live stream show on Twitch devoted a full hour to the Indian farmers' dispute. Here's some of what he had to say.
Neoliberals be like, I don't understand. It seems like they're going to get priced out. There will never be a deregulated market. Sounds like they're creating a vacuum for industrial farming to take over. Yes.
Gamer and infotainment live streamer Hassan Piker ending that report from Rob Osborne. High school is when teenagers have their communications disabilities identified. But not all high schools have access to speech pathology services for their students. Research done by the University of Sydney found that in some states, there's zero or minimal government-backed speech pathology services at public schools. Wing Kwang has found out more.
According to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, 1.2 million Australians have communication disability, with tens of thousands of them being teenagers. These young people struggle with speaking, listening, reading, writing, and other social communication skills. To better support them, many public schools have speech pathologists to get involved. However, a new research by the University of Sydney found that not all public schools share equal access to speech pathology services. Nicola Shelton is a co-researcher.
We surveyed 96 speech-language pathologists, SLPs, across Australia who work with 12 to 16-year-olds. And we found that SLPs in states that have this government-mandated provision of services, so that's Queensland, South Australia, Tasmania and Victoria, 49% of those respondents were working in a government service. Other states and territories either have zero or else very minimal government provision of SLP services, so it might be the case that they only provide services for the very youngest school-aged children. In those states, which are the ACT, New South Wales, WA, and it would include the Northern Territory, but we didn't have any respondents from there in our survey, we found that only 15% of respondents were employed by a government service.
The research also looks into the intervention support for high school students with communication disability. This means speech pathologists would work collaboratively with teachers during the teaching in classrooms. The survey found states with government-mandated speech pathology services offer more support than those with zero or minimal government-mandated provision. This also means for those who couldn't access these services, they have to seek private support or even miss out the treatments.
Private practitioners are sometimes unaffordable for particular families. So while they provide really vital services for lots and lots of families, those that aren't able to access their services are then left behind. And so we're kind of concerned about that equitable access. Who's being left behind by not being able to receive those government-mandated services?
Tim Kitto is the national president of Speech Pathology Australia. He said he was not surprised to see the survey result. Kitto said high school is when patterns of communication disability occur. Speech pathologists can identify them. But in a school setting, teachers are not usually trained with knowledge of speech pathology. These students could then be seen with behavior difficulties. Kitto said many people believed speech disorders could be healed just by a couple of years. But in fact, communication disability could start to manifest differently in high school, which would require a different set of skills to work on it. Kitto also stressed the importance of having government-supported speech pathology services at school.
When you actually have speech pathology occurring outside of a school, it's very, very difficult to actually get those gains that are being made happening in the educational setting as well. So for those states that don't have, like the ACT, New South Wales or Western Australia, the idea of actually just having some pilot programs and actually seeing what a benefit it can be would be amazing.
President of Speech Pathology Australia Tim Kittle ending that report by Wing Kwang. Over the weekend, Republicans from all over America gathered at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Orlando, Florida. Prominent senators such as Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley delivered speeches. But the biggest draw was, of course, Donald Trump's first public speech since leaving office. In a polarising 90-minute speech, Mr. Trump repeated lies about voter fraud, made claims about women's sports deemed transphobic by many, and affirmed his commitment to the Republican Party. Ryan Stanton asked Brendan O'Connor, Associate Professor at the University of Sydney, specialising in American studies, to explain why CPAC is so significant.
Well, in the late 1970s, early 80s, conservative political action committees really took control of American politics. They became a huge deal in terms of steering politics to the right. Sort of before there was Obama raising millions and billions on the internet, there was CPAC with direct mail, you know, sending out letters, stoking up the people of small churches, evangelical Americans particularly. Now CPAC is really the sort of dominant voice, and its annual conference in some ways is this place where the socially conservative side of the party really, you know, gets its act together, gets its voice heard.
Obviously, the biggest talking point of CPAC was Trump's speech. What can the contents of his keynote tell us about the current focus of the Republican Party?
Well, for your listeners, I subjected myself to the 90 minutes of the Trump speech. The best word for it is a Jeremiad, a word Americans like to use, a kind of casting in some ways from the wilderness into the sort of public discourse, a set of arguments about what is really wrong, broken about the United States. So it's this sort of mournful, highly sort of critical speech of current American society, full of, as we're used to with Trump, untruths, wild exaggerations. The dimensions of the various things he covers in the speech are things that we're familiar with largely. One of these typically sprawling rants from Trump in many regards.
Trump announced his desire to remain within the Republican Party, squashing rumors about a possible third Trump party. Is there a chance that the Republican Party may not reciprocate these feelings and want to disassociate from him at this point?
Well, that is going to be the big question, isn't it? I mean, is the Republican Party going to become a party of fantasy, of conspiracy, or are they going to be a party that sort of attaches itself to addressing political realities, realities like global warming or the COVID virus itself? I think wise observers really since the 1980s on American politics have said this pursuit of fantasy on the right side of American politics, the conservative movement side of American politics, has been a pretty successful electoral strategy, but as a governing strategy, it is a disaster.
Trump's speech hammered home many of his traditional talking points, but while they were received positively by CPAC, polls show that support for him from the attendance was less enthusiastic. Is Trumpism centred on the man himself a one-and-done movement, or can we expect to see more people like him pop up around the globe?
It's a good question, because on one side, some people say, well, stoking up fear and resentment with lies isn't that hard. You know, other people could do it. Whether Trump's background in real estate and then in television was a key ingredient, I think will be a really interesting question in the years ahead. And that is really a dilemma that I think lies ahead in kind of studying populist politicians around the world to say, well, was this guy the kind of high point, or in many regards, was it actually a pretty simple formula of stoking up resentment, disgruntlement, nationalism that Trump was onto? And, you know, actually, other people can follow in his footsteps, and you don't have to actually be that smart or know that much about politics to do this.
Brendan O'Connor, Associate Professor at the University of Sydney, ending that report by Ryan Stanton. In Melbourne today, Michael Gadinski, a powerhouse of the Australian music industry, died aged 68. From the 60s on, Michael brought to Australia the best music the world had to offer with his Frontier Touring Company. He nurtured new Australian talent with his Mushroom record label and helped so many people on the way. Stuart Coop's written a book on Michael Gadinski and has worked with him as a band manager and promoter in the Australian music industry.
It's almost impossible to talk about Australian music from the 1960s through to the present day without talking about the pivotal role that Michael played, from the formation of Mushroom Records through through to the Frontier Touring Company that, you know, done so many amazing international tours, the Mushroom Publishing Company, the booking agency, you know, all of the things. And then you look at all of the artists that have been associated with Michael Gudinski. You know, we're talking about Skyhook, Split Enz, Kylie Minogue, Cold Chisel, Paul Kelly, The Sports, hundreds of pictures. I could go on and on and on.
And still, recently, you know, he brought out Ed Sheeran, didn't he, and John Bon Jovi. Everyone that could have passed Australia by, he's actually managed to get big-name acts to us here in Australia, hasn't he?
Well, you know, he's one of the significant promoters in this country and has been for many, many years. Not the only one, of course, but look, you know, he brought Bruce Springsteen to Australia many, many times. You know, he toured the Rolling Stones. You know, he's done a lot of huge names. But, you know, probably more significantly, he was still involved right to the very end with grassroots nurturing of Australian music. The Found television show, you know, the kind of what we call the new countdown on the ABC. You know, during COVID, what was Gudinski doing, sitting around moaning? Not a chance. You know, he was out creating this new television show to expose, you know, some established but a lot of Australian talent. His label was still running Mushroom Records. You know, the last time I talked to him, you know, he was just going, you know, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm doing this, and just never stopped. So yes, look, you know, he loved Ed Sheeran and toured many times. You know, he Frontier Touring had done, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of international tours. So yes, his role in bringing these artists to Australia is, you know, immeasurable. You know, he was the guy behind the entertainment of the AFL Grand Final. You know, if you could think of something, Gudinski was there, you know, helping out and getting artists on and getting them exposure and doing things to help them.
Because he was a big St Kilda fan, wasn't he, along with Molly Meldrum?
Yes, he was. For many years, he was on the board of the St Kilda Football Club. So he was a rabid St Kilda Football Club supporter. Yeah.
But it's quite a shock for most people, isn't it? I mean, he was at the Oils gig just recently, a couple of days ago.
Yeah, which I didn't realise. I didn't see him. I was there on Thursday night, and I heard this morning that he was there. Look, yes, of course, you know, anyone dying at 68 years of age is a shock. You know, it's young. You know, Michael lived his life like there was no tomorrow. You know, his work ethic was unbelievable.
And he gave back, didn't he? I mean, he put together industry events like Sound Relief for the Queensland floods and then followed up with Sound Relief for bushfires. He supported Indigenous artists like Uncle Archie Roach. He's the forefront of things like that.
Yeah, look, all the things that you've mentioned. He worked with a lot of Indigenous artists. First and foremost, he loved music. You know, he loved the hustle. He loved the deal. He loved the excitement. And, you know, he never lost that almost childlike enthusiasm.
Is there a moment you had with him which sort of comes to mind?
Look, I mean, with Michael, I had a bad period in my life some years ago. You know, who was the first person on the phone going, I hear you're not travelling too well. Do you want to go and stay at one of my houses and things like that? What can I do? You know, that's the sort of person that Michael Gudinski was. You know, like I was at his house at one point doing an interview for my Paul Kelly book, you know, and my partner at the time was suffering from breast cancer. He just went out into the garden and got her a flower and he said, take this home with you. So no, he was, you know, he was an incredible individual. But you know, look, I loved him in full flight. I remember particularly, you know, one day I was over in Los Angeles, you know, managing Paul Kelly and learning from Michael Gudinski how to be a manager and how the American music industry worked. And I remember once, you know, he was staying at a quite expensive hotel. I was staying at a cheap hotel. And he said, I'll pick you up in the morning. And he pulled up in a convertible, stood up on his seat, said, I love L.A., and put his fist in the air. And then we drove off to do a day of business at A&M Records. You couldn't, every time you were around Michael, you remember it. Promised land, and I'll be there someday if you could hold my hand.
Stuart Coop, host of 2SER's Dirt Music for the Community Radio Network, speaking with me there following the passing of Michael Gudinski. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to The Wire. So we've got for you on The Wire today. You can find all our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Look for The Wire Radio. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney and broadcast around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, we produce The Wire on Gadigal Country of the Eora Nation and, of course, with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do keep well and thanks for your company.
Took him to his grave and they cared.